Action Group.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
Today, from the Wings Archive.
If it doesn't concern women, it's important news. And somehow, if it's about women or, quote, a woman's issue, it's not real news.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In September 2023, the U.S.-based feminist magazine Ms., spelled M-S, released a book about its first 50 years of publishing. Ms. was a term U.S. feminists had chosen to replace the designations Miss and Mrs., which divided women according to marital status. A mere 20 years after the Ms. preview edition was published, Ms. Editor-in-Chief Robin Morgan gave the following address at a United Nations symposium on sex stereotypes in media. She'd just watched the Senate approve Clarence Thomas to replace venerable civil rights activist Thurgood Marshall on the U.S. Supreme Court. You will hear her mention that Thomas had headed the EEOC. That's the U.S. government's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. From the Wings Archive, 1991, here is Robin Morgan.
I come to you, of course, fresh from the disaster, both in the Senate and the Imperial Presidency, over Clarence Thomas and Professor Anita Hill, but also from the media disaster during that same period. And that's one of the things that I want to address, because I'm still somehow bananas over the whole situation, as are indeed most women in this country, and quite a few sisters in the international community as well. Obviously, it would have been much more different in the committee if half the committee itself were female. Just trip on that for a moment. Or if half the committee in particular were female and African-American. Trip on that for a moment. The very questions, the style, the mode would have been different. But also the coverage. If women had been in positions of real influence, decision-making, and power in the media. I don't think it's coincidental that the first news person to break the so-called leak was Nina Totenberg of National Public Radio. At the same time, a memo from the EEOC archives, which Judge Thomas had written when he was chair of the EEOC, a memo which I would have called the smoking gun, a memo in which he said flat out that he really felt that the guidelines on sexual harassment were far too broad and that the EEOC was being plagued with mailbags of trivial complaints about this issue from around the country, and that he highly recommended that, given the limited funds of the agency, they really do no more on this issue. Now, this was a memo he wrote in 1980 when chair of the EEOC. The actual memo... is from Clarence Thomas to Jay Parker, re-EEOC, date December 22, 1980. And this was part of the, during the Reagan transition team. It goes on, and we don't have the time for it, but I will read you. The vagueness of the definition of sexual harassment discrimination has led to a barrage of trivial complaints against employers around the nation. The elimination of personal slights and sexual advances which contribute to a, quote, intimidating, hostile, or offensive working environment is a goal impossible to reach. Expenditure of the EEOC's limited resources in pursuit of this goal is unwise. Now, I think that's news. And a lot of newswomen thought that was news, but that was the memo that we so far have not really been able to get into the press. Various newswomen in this country tried to get that memo into the media. I was one. First, I rang a friendly senator friendly to women, who shall be nameless, fulminating over the telephone. There is this memo. There's a memo. And faxed it down immediately to that senator's offices. And that particular senator felt that it was so important a document that it was hand-walked to the committee. That senator was not sitting on the committee. At which point the committee said, oh, yes, that memo, we have that in our archive. We've had that for some time. It hasn't been introduced as evidence. So when the senator told me this, my response was, and what do we do? And just, you know, and the response was, well, since I'm not sitting on the committee, I can't force its introduction. At this point, we rely on the press. If it is splashed everywhere in the press, the committee will have to deal with it. So it's up to you folks. So I got on the phone and I rang Sisters in the Press, Ellen Goodman at the Boston Globe, hand-walked it to the national desk. She herself is a columnist. Anna Quindlen at the New York Times, hand-walked it to the national desk. She is a columnist. Judy Mann at the Washington Post, also a columnist, hand-walked it to the national desk, at which point it disappeared. It just sort of vanished. The only reason that it went out at all, and only a very tepid extract from it, not the most frightening lines. They did go out over the Associated Press wires, and this was because two women, who shall be nameless in a rare fit of discretion, I will not name them for their protection, went to their editor and said, this is very important. And their editor, who was a man, said, oh, I don't think it's really that relevant. No, we won't send it out over the wires. And at the risk of their job, they send it out over the wires anyway. Since all that they could get snuck out over the wires were a few lines, it then promptly died as well. In addition, a story documenting Thomas's credit card records as a pornography buyer has been languishing at Newsweek for almost a month, with women staffers there desperately trying to get it into the magazine. It will probably be running in the next week's issue of Newsweek. The editors felt that to run it ahead of the vote, when indeed it might have changed the vote and given more implicit validity to Professor Hill's statement, would be to hold themselves open to accusation of a media feeding frenzy, you see. All of which boils down to 101, which is that if it doesn't concern women, it's important news. It's grown-up real stuff. And somehow, if it's about women or tainted with women, much less if it is by and for and quote, a woman's issue, and we think all issues are women's issues, then it's not real news. This is not going to change until and unless we have more women, very simply, in positions of power. You do see now a visual change in much of the media. For example, you will see many more anchor women. Very frequently, what feminists around the world call the two-for-one syndrome. In other words, for the sake of one salary, they not only have their woman, but she will also be African-American, Asian-American, Native American, etc. It's a real bargain. God forbid they should hire two, three, four people from groups that have been kept invisible or relatively voiceless. But even there, if you watch the credits, most of the time, 80% of the time or more, the news desks, the editors, the directors, the producers of the news programs on television media are men. I don't mean to be so simplistic as to male bash, although every feminist has her moments. And there certainly are principled men and men of conscience who do sympathize and try to change this situation. Unfortunately, those are not usually the men who are in positions of real power. And even those who are well-meaning don't always seem to quite get it. The issue of sexual harassment was precisely one such issue, where if it's an extreme case of almost assault, then they could understand this. But the whole concept of a hostile atmosphere, of verbal assault, many of even those well-meaning men had great difficulty wrapping their minds around that concept, where most women understood immediately. There are a couple of other things I want to touch on very quickly. I am one who will say quite blatantly, in terms of the basic question, you know, should the media activate or influence public opinion, or should it be, quote, objective, that I believe the concept of objective journalism is a lie. At least in my country, in the United States, I must confess I've never encountered objective journalism. What passes for objective journalism is usually white, European-American, ethnocentric, frequently racist, and perpetually sexist reporting. But that, you see, is the norm in a patriarchy, and so that passes for objective. When you try to get in other news and other slants of vision about the have-nots in this country, women, peoples of color, poor people, etc., you know, that then suddenly becomes advocacy journalism. So as far as I'm concerned, the voice of the have-nots is objective journalism, since it's inclusive of the reality of the real world. And the basic patriarchal voice is what is advocacy journalism, even though it's what we get all the time. There is an additional, well, two additional elements that I think are really crucial to our discussion, and I've noticed both of these elements occur, so it seems, cross-culturally, because I've been fortunate enough to work in the international network, and I have heard similar complaints and seen similar situations, whether it's in the Philippines, whether it's in Palestine, Israel, whether it is in the favelas of Brazil, all across Europe, in the Pacific. One is language itself, and certainly this is an issue that we're all familiar with, the sexism that's inherent in language. You know, and every time we raise this, somebody scoffs and says, oh, well, you're just being picky. I mean, by saying mankind, you know, we mean womankind. We mean to include women. Well, the founders of this country, when they said, you know, all men are created equal, they really meant all men are created. In fact, they meant all white men are created equal. They really meant this. Women didn't have the vote. African Americans didn't have, I mean, they really meant what they said. So we're a little bit tired and beyond the stage of having to read ourselves between the lines in all of these cases. And I've suggested that if one word, you know, is as good as another and will pass for inclusive, then we can just refer to womankind, and men can know that we really mean to include them in that too. Or the sisterhood of man, for example. But it is indeed a very serious issue, and I don't think I ever realized in practice how serious it is in general media. As an individual writer, and particularly as a poet obsessed with language, this had been an old fever of mine. But since I have been editor-in-chief of the new ad-free Ms. magazine, I can't tell you how important the care that we all take with language really is. And it goes across the board, obviously not only on issues of sexism, but on issues of racism. For example, we always say Asian American, African American, Native American, Latina American, etc. But we have now begun to say European American, because otherwise white is still the generic. We have an international board of advisors on this new Ms. because it's international. And on that board of advisors are distinguished women writers and journalists from, I think, 26 countries, including one from Israel and one from Palestine. We do not list the Palestinian member as a Palestinian. We list her as from Palestine. In other words, the magazine is trying to reflect not only the world as it is, but the world as women would like it to be. And that affects every phrase, every piece of language that we use in terms of ageism, in terms of homophobia, in terms of race, class, etc. And it affects the readership, because the readers write in and say, you know, I never really thought of that. And these are, you know, educated women, and they've been feminists already for 20 years, but somehow the language slipped by them.
From the Wings Archive, this is Robin Morgan, then editor-in-chief of Ms. Magazine, discussing sex stereotypes in media in 1991.
The last thing, and perhaps, well, certainly one of the most crucial, at least in terms of the United States, and I've seen this occur, I must say, elsewhere, is advertising. If there is a sex stereotype about women in the United States, it is that we are free. And, of course, that's one of the funniest things to come down the pike since George Bush got elected. That we are liberated women, that we have all this sexual license, that we wanted sexual license. There's that deliberate confusing of the sexual revolution, which never happened for women, with feminism. There is a media distortion about what feminism itself is, so that very frequently in my travels around the world, I've encountered in my sisters the media perception that they have picked up on of what feminism is, as if it were, with all due respect, Betty Friedan's rather narrow definition, equal pay for equal work, child care, you know, reproductive freedom, etc., period. In the 13 years of working with women from 80 different countries all over the world, the 13 years of putting together Sisterhood is Global, it became quite celebratorily clear that all issues are women's issues, and that feminism in its widest and most profound sense, whether or not the label is attached to it, is a rising tide of global activism. And we saw that in the UN Decade for Women, in the three conferences, and we've just begun. We're not finished just because the decade is over. But in this country in particular, advertising functions as a de facto covert and overt censor. The reason that this Ms., this incarnation of Ms., can afford to actually function like a free press, to have the words that are supposedly unspeakable on its masthead, to use the language we do a minimum of 6 pages of international news in each issue, plus at least one in-depth international feature, to do investigative reporting, to name names, to bring back poetry and fiction of really first world-class level from writers all over the world, to run a whole section on ecofeminism, environmental feminism. The reason we're able to do any of those things is because we jettisoned advertising. The long history of the magazine itself is 18 years old, and ran advertising for all of those years up to 1990, when I came on as editor-in-chief. And I had 3 basic grounds, which I thought were unattainable, because I was quite happy being an organizer and writing books. And my 3 grounds were total editorial autonomy, no advertising whatsoever, and that I could take the magazine in an international direction. Well, to my absolute horror, all 3 grounds were met, so I was stuck. And I have hardly had time to wash my hair since January 1990, but it is indeed worth it, because previous to that time, I had been a contributing editor, for example, and written for the magazine. And I can give you one of many horror stories. In 1980, I flew to Vienna to do the first in-depth interview with 4 Soviet women who had been sent into involuntary exile for publishing the first feminist samizdat from Leningrad. And they had done this against just extraordinary odds. Even the male dissident community had not supported them, had said it was divisive. This is familiar. And the KGB had come down on them very forcefully. They'd been sent into exile. This was quite an amazing interview. The women were extremely generous with their time and their confidence, and we ran it in the magazine as a cover story in November of 1980, and it won 3 major journalism awards. But the magazine, which was still taking advertising at that point, lost a major account, which was Revlon. Now, why? Because these 4 wonderful, strong women's faces on the cover of the magazine were not wearing makeup. And the stories go on from there. The magazine was the first to break the story of the toxic shock syndrome because of tampons. Immediately, of course, all tampon ads were pulled from the magazine. Now, in that case, they did come back to the magazine in 2-3 months, because by that time the story was running in every newspaper, and it was simply, they couldn't selectively punish Ms. But Ms. was restrained from running stories on battery, for example, on battered women, because liquor manufacturers know, just as the women's movement has pointed out all around the world, that there is, in fact, a connection between male alcoholism and spousal battery. There were lots of stories that the magazine either couldn't run or had to run in a somewhat watered-down form. There is a thing called complementary copy, which advertisers require, particularly of women's magazines. This means that if you want to get advertising for, say, food products, you have to run recipes. If you want advertising for clothing, you have to run fashion. And, you know, the old saying, if they come for you at night and I do nothing, they'll come for me in the morning. Well, it's been true about women's magazines in particular for years. In the magazine industry in this country, women's magazines are called cash cows. Literally catalogs for products, and the actual editorial copy, that's just filler. But since it was so successful in that respect for advertisers, with relatively little protest and despair, just apathy from women. Now it's showing in sales decline. Advertisers expanded this then. They came for the rest in the morning. And now when you open general magazines like Time or Newsweek, you will see advertorials, which is a particularly sneaky way of getting something in, because you're reading along and it looks like the rest of the magazine, except you happen to notice that what Chrysler is mentioned awfully frequently in this article on cars. And then if you look down in two-point type with a magnifying glass at the very bottom, it says Advertorial Chrysler Corporation. Well, now we're free of all that. We did what everyone said was impossible to do, as if to the Wright brothers, no Orville, it will never get off the ground. And we did a huge mailing to subscribers and to women's mailing lists and said, if you want a free press, then you're going to have to own it. And this means the subscription will cost a little more. But we can't deal that old way anymore. And the response came in. The first issue, which came out in July 1990, sold out overnight. We went back to press for doubling the press run, and it sold out overnight. The estimation was that we would be extremely lucky. Don't forget, this is a 100-page issue, each issue, and it's bi-monthly, but each issue is a double issue, of pure copy, art and editorial, no ads. We were told that we would be exceedingly lucky if by the end of 1992, the end of this of next year, we would have 75,000 subscribers, very lucky, and if we sold 5,000 to 10,000 on newsstands, because we don't do movie star covers, you see. And everyone in the industry said, well, in particular, U.S. readers aren't interested in international. They're very, you know, turned inward. Poetry and fiction, blah, that will be too literary. In-depth news reporting, that'll be, you know, too intellectual. And it'll look like a journal, and it'll all be boring. And besides, the feminist movement is over, which everybody has been announcing yearly for the last 25 years. We don't listen to them. We just go about our business. So I'm very delighted to tell you that as of our first anniversary, which was July of this year, not only had we made those figures, but are now approaching 200,000 subscribers, nationally and internationally, and the magazine sells approximately 75,000 copies on newsstands. The international readership which we have pursued, I feel that in all honor we now can pursue, simply because of a policy that I've established, which is that whenever women in other countries are covered in depth, that coverage is done by women of those countries, so as to avoid the egregious North American feminist imperialism that we're all a bit tired of from the past. Even, you know, well-meant errors or cultural insensitivities, this makes that a thing of the past. And the International Board of Advisors is indeed a wonderful help in precisely that respect. I guess what it shows, and what I'll leave you with in the heartening news department, is that the readership, largely in North America, but not at all exclusively, we have about, I think, 10,000 subscribers internationally, and we've only now begun distribution in newsstands internationally, and we have fantasy dreams of editions in translation. It shows that the readers, mostly women, but certainly some men of conscience, were hungry for some real food, and the letters reflect that. They were tired, they say, of junk food. It shows that they're really ready for the truth. It shows that they want to know about the other half of the human species. During the Gulf War, for example, at considerable risk to life and limb, materials were faxed to us, sort of daily dispatches from women in Kuwait, in Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, in West Bank, and in Israel. All of them feminist activists, all of them peace activists, and all of them showing the other side of the war than was being shown on television, what was really happening to women, to children. And I guess it goes back to a basic news adage that when the presence of information is there, and it's the truth, and it's the full story, and you can name names, and you can target products, in fact, as we did with Folgers Coffee, because in Central America, some women coffee pickers were trying to organize, their headquarters were bombed. It turned out they were Folgers Coffee fields. When a small television station in Boston ran this story, Folgers pulled all of its ads from the station, and the station affiliate, which was CBS, Procter & Gamble, which owns Folger, threatened to pull all of its ads from CBS. That story never appeared in electronic media thereafter. But we ran the story, including the fact that PNG had threatened CBS and that Folgers had pulled its ads from the station. The idea that the truth can be got at, or the truths in a complexity of reporting can be got at, and that quality work by good writers can simply be connected with the hunger of people to know, I think is a very real one and a very simple one. It's not easy. We're still just scraping by. We know we're not about to fold any minute. We still get along with a staff of 14 women. That includes copy, production, art department, all of editorial, fact-checking as well. So we're all of us a bit tired. But the idea that we can begin to provide, which is perhaps the best contribution that U.S. women can make to the international women's movement, access for our sisters around the world to make their voices heard at their own choosing, on the issues they choose and in the ways they decide, is what we're about. To my great delight and honor, the voices are coming in, and to my personal joy, my sisters in this country are hungry for that news and are acting on it. So I guess it shows the simple basics. Freedom of the press belongs to those who own the press and who can make the decisions and the risks they're involved, whether it's from language, whether it's on subject matter, whether it's on context. And that's the way, perhaps, through freeing the word, that we can free women, or at least one of the ways. Since most of our sisters around the world are non-literate, and since, although the general illiteracy rate is falling, the female illiteracy rate is rising, print media is hardly the answer to everything. But the hunger is so great that at least we can address it. And my last little parable will be of a woman named Gunawa, whom I talked with at some length in a rice paddy in the Cordilleras in the Philippines. She had 12 children. She was about my age and looked maybe 20 years older. When we sat on the mud floor of her hut in the rice paddy, she'd been abandoned by her husband. She was a female-headed household, and she worked back-breaking labor every day in the paddies. And while we sat and talked through an interpreter, a woman interpreter, she said the same sentence, in a sense, that I've heard from women in the favelas and from women in the Palestinian refugee camps. In the Middle East, from women in a sense all over the world. When I asked her what she most wanted for her life, she said to learn to read. And I said, not better housing, more food, some easement of the severe labor that you do every day. And she smiled, and with great dignity, she said, no, to read. My great pride is that some of my children are learning how to read. My great sorrow is that I don't know how, because, you see, someday, she said, I might go somewhere, and I've heard that there are signs on the road, and if I knew how to read, I could read the signs, and I could know where I was going. And perhaps that's our job as women in the media, to help all of us, ourselves included, find out where we're going. Thank you.
Robin Morgan is a feminist theorist and activist, a poet, a podcaster, former editor-in-chief, and now global editor of Ms. Magazine. Among her many books are Sisterhood is Powerful, Sisterhood is Global, Sisterhood is Forever, and The Demon Lover on the Sexuality of Terrorism. Ms. Magazine published a book in 2023 titled 50 Years of Ms., the best of the pathfinding magazine that ignited a revolution. It is still independent but now quarterly and has an online store. WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, was co-founded by Catherine Davenport and Frieda Worden in 1986. For more about our weekly programming and extensive archives, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange, and other works on the gift economy. She hosts salons at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Did you know that LGBT students hear anti-gay slurs an average of 26 times a day? One out of every four LGBT youth are told to leave home. LGBT youth are more likely to be homeless. 30% of suicides are LGBT. PFLAG is committed to anyone struggling with sexual orientation and gender identity issues. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.